This week on Vaticano, embark on a journey tracing the footsteps of the resurrection, venturing to Rome and Turin to explore the revered Shroud of Turin. Meet Bishop Robert Barron to delve into the root causes of the spiritual crisis facing today's youth, and discover the significance and insights surrounding the Urbi et Orbi blessing. For this and more, Vaticano starts now. German bishops will have to seek Vatican approval for future decisions regarding their synodal way. Tensions between the Holy See and the Church in Germany have intensified since the German Bishops' Conference launched the Synodal Way in 2019. In cooperation with a lay body, the Central Committee of German Catholics, the aim of most of the German bishops was to bring about change within the Church. It was not only in Germany that many Catholics feared that their shepherds were taking a dangerous path that threatened unity with the universal Church. In Rome, too, there's growing concern about the whole undertaking. For this reason, a delegation from the German Synodal Way once again traveled to the Vatican on the 22nd of March to discuss the main issues with representatives of the Roman dicasteries. In a joint statement after the meeting, both sides declared that the talks were characterized by a, quote, positive and constructive atmosphere. The German bishops also assured that they want to develop concrete forms of synodality in the Church in Germany that are in line with the ecclesiology of the Second Vatican Council, the requirements of canon law, and the results of the World Synod. The statement also says that all future plans of the German bishops to implement their ideas of synodality are to be submitted to the Vatican for approval. Most recently, the Vatican had stopped the German Bishops' Conference's plans to set up a synodal committee. The protagonists of the worldwide Synod on Synodality are also looking at the developments from Germany with caution. 1 week before the German delegation's meeting with the Vatican, the Secretary General of the Synod of Bishops, Cardinal Mario Grech, said,
I think the German bishops are in union with the Holy Father, and if they follow the Holy Father, then the way forward is open.
The next meeting between the German delegation and the Vatican is planned for the summer, just a few weeks before the next assembly of the Synod on Synodality in October.
I think the key questions around truth and justice and liberty have to be centered immediately, focused or centered immediately on what it means to be a human being.
At a time when the quest for truth, justice, and freedom is more urgent than ever, a group of scholars, theologians, and students came together in Rome to ask, will the 2025 Jubilee mark a turning point in the intellectual and spiritual pandemic which has plagued modern man for a quarter century? Is it still possible to reverse course amid a landscape of deviant anthropologies and secularized politics? The Acton Institute, with the Pontifical Gregorian University's Faculty of Philosophy, held an international conference on truth, justice, and liberty in a pluri-anthropological world with more than 300 leaders in church social thought. Dr. Michael Miller of the Acton Institute spoke at this conference on the five false anthropologies and the role the church has in responding to these societal changes.
The church has key things to do, and as it always has to done. You know, I mean, I think it's St. Augustine said something like, don't wish to live in the future, don't just live in the past. You know, be content with where God puts you. And the church has the message, I would say, you know, the good news, the gospel. Part of the gospel is the good news, the gospel about the human person, what it means to be a human person. So I think the church has to teach anthropology. I think continue to teach and revive maybe even the theology of the body that John Paul so developed so well.
The organizing committee stressed that it was particularly important to have these conversations in the Eternal City.
And so here, of course, in Rome, in the center of the Catholic Church, the center of the world, really, we thought it was important to have this conversation where we talk about truth and justice, but from the lens of the human person created in the image of God.
Underpinning the entire conference was the certainty of Catholic truths and the need to share them with the wider society in these times of difficulty and confusion.
I think that the clearest, most coherent, and also most elegant vision of the human person that aligns with our lived experience and gives us a mental model of how to navigate a complex world is Catholic anthropology, and so it's something that we need to share.
As the Eternal City continues its preparations for the 2025 Jubilee, the conference invites us all to begin preparing spiritually.
Hello and welcome to this week's Vaticano Updates, the most important news from the Holy Father and the Vatican. At the end of his Palm Sunday Mass, Pope Francis offered prayers for the victims of the terrorist attack in Moscow. At least 130 people died after gunmen opened fire at a musical performance in a Moscow concert hall on March 22nd. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for the attack in Russia. Pope Francis's laicized Bishop Emeritus of Bruges, Belgium, Roger van Galuwe, the 87-year-old former prelate, had admitted to repeatedly sexually abusing his nephew when the latter was a minor. The Apostolic Nunciature to Belgium confirmed that the pontiff granted the request, ordering that the proposed sentence be imposed after the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith recommended the bishop's dismissal from the clergy. Pope Francis spoke on the important role public broadcasting plays in the transmission of information and serving the common good. In an address to the managers, journalists, and the staff of RAI, Italy's national public broadcasting company, Francis pointed to the imperative of combating the spread of viral misinformation and the, and I quote, devious plans of those who seek to influence public opinion in an ideological manner, lying and disintegrating the social fabric. The pontiff issued new regulations for the administration of the Papal Basilica of St. Mary Major, placing new emphasis on spiritual work and pastoral care, and appointing a coadjutor archpriest of the West's oldest Marian shrine. The basilica has been an important place for Pope Francis, who prays there before the icon Salus Populi Romani, before and after all his apostolic journeys. In December 2023, he expressed his desire to be buried in the basilica and not in the crypt of St. Peter's Basilica. The Holy Father will travel by motorboat along Venice's canals and offer Mass in St. Mark's Square during his visit to the floating city in northern Italy. Pope Francis will preside over the public Mass on Sunday, April the 28th, as he visits the Vatican Pavilion at the Venice Biennale Art Exhibit. After that, the pontiff will privately venerate the relics of St. Mark the Evangelist inside the basilica. And now the most important news at the end. Christ is truly risen. Hallelujah. Happy Easter, Andreas Tonhauser for EWTN Vaticano.
In a few moments, we'll be back with more on Vaticano.
Either the resurrection is a historical fact, or I have thrown my life into nothingness and spent it for nothing.
In the past, Christians' belief in the resurrection of Christ was sufficiently supported by faith in the Gospels, the Church Fathers, and the Church itself. However, since the 18th century, the rise of scientific rationalism has led many to question this event, prompting a search for scientific evidence. Amidst this quest, one relic stands out for its profound mystery and its ability to captivate and astonish. The Shroud of Turin. Despite over a century of thorough study, this relic continues to pose numerous questions, challenging the skepticism of many. Father Maurizio Botta, a priest devoted to the shroud, explains why this may be the most important relic the Church possesses.
All the wounds described in the Gospel are compatible with those we find in the shroud. It is not known how it was formed even today, with all the experiments they have done. They have tried 1,000 ways to explain it. They are all hypotheses.
Skepticism about the shroud began as scientific progress led people to believe that miracles and the supernatural could be explained by science and new technologies. Soon, however, scientists were faced with questions still unanswered today, such as the unique characteristics of the Shroud of Turin. Nello Balossino, a scientific researcher and longtime Shroud scholar, explains more about these details.
The shrouds that are shroud-like have a very big flaw, and that is, they are all reproductions made by deteriorating the shroud threads. That is, by burning them, for example, either with heat or sulfuric acid. But the shroud, the fibers of the shroud, are intact, and this is the very first characteristic. The second problem is what I have mentioned earlier, talking about the three-dimensionality. And that is, the three-dimensionality is an intrinsic feature of the shroud that does not exist in other images.
International interest in the shroud began in 1898, after it was first photographed at the behest of King Umberto I of Italy. Today, the original negatives of those early photos can be appreciated in Rome's Museum of the Popes, a stone's throw from St. Peter's. Ivan Marsura owns the film negatives of those first images and shows them to us.
Here, already we see the shroud displayed inside the Turin Cathedral, and we see it quite sharply. And there's also a nice detail, because there's an attendant from the service of the Turin Cathedral, the weekend glimpse behind the candelabra. And that makes all the details for us, all very sharp and very clean details. Here, however, we already see the face, and these are two details taken from Pia's first photographs, and we already have the detail of the face in negative and in positive.
Can this image, therefore, really be the face of Christ? Could the shroud kept in Turin be the ultimate proof of Christ's resurrection?
If I wanted to give an exhaustive talk about all the evidence that somehow could lead us to say that that is likely, I use that term to say that there is a slight dividing line to the fact that there was the body of Christ. The investigations are multidisciplinary. So I talked about the photography, but there's also, of course, forensic medicine that makes its contribution because it says, what is the type of blood that is on the shroud? There is palynology, because on the shroud, there are pollens that have been found that can be related to European pollens, but also to Palestinian pollens. There are the morphological investigations that suggest how the crucifixion of the Sindonic man took place.
Despite all these tests and experiments, we cannot yet be scientifically certain that the man in the shroud is actually Christ.
On the level of principle, I do not need the shroud in order to believe. However, in front of the shroud, I put myself in the same position as this first photographer who photographed it. I put myself humanly in the image of this man who, we can imagine, tripod, cloth on his shoulders, flash, and when he saw the impressed plate respond in that way and appear outlined, the body with all the wounds, with everything legible, he must have wept. And I keep seeing that commotion, that crying in front of the shroud.
If you're told that there's no transcendent point of reference, nothing beyond this world, all there is, you know, matter in motion, things dumbly here, we've come from nowhere, we're going nowhere. That produces, of course, a deep you know, thunderstorm in the heart and in the soul.
In the midst of the ongoing spiritual crisis within the church, young people are the first ones to suffer. U.S. Bishop Robert Barron explained, "The immanentism, materialism, and secularism that has taken hold of much of Western culture not only produces high rates of anxiety and depression among the youth, but also leaves them yearning for a fulfillment that the world cannot provide."
We know from St. Augustine and from the Bible, the heart longs for God. Nothing in this world can satisfy the hungry heart. You can deceive yourself for a while, and that happens to a lot of younger people, that, you know, enough money and pleasure and power in this world, I'll be happy. But the heart knows otherwise and will rebel against that sort of immanentism.
In man's unavoidable and relentless pursuit of purpose and fulfillment, the bishop emphasized, we try to quench an unquenchable thirst, stemming from our separation from God, with anything that crosses our path.
It's the old idols, you know, the Bible knew about it, of sex and pleasure, power, fame, self-esteem, you know, we'll fill in that empty space with anything the world can give us. The problem is, as John of the Cross told us, we have these infinite caverns inside of us. And so no matter how much you throw into those caverns, it's not gonna fill it up. They can be filled only by God, by the infinite.
During his recent visit to Rome, Bishop Barron celebrated a mass of thanksgiving for Father Paul Murray, professor of spiritual theology, departing the Angelicum after 3 decades of teaching. In his homage to Father Murray, Bishop Barron extolled his contributions as a spiritual theologian, emphasizing the centrality of grace in his teachings and writings, which offer valuable insights into the spiritual life.
The Dominican tradition plays such a premium on the initiative that God takes in both the metaphysical and spiritual orders. Long before we even feel the urge to come to God, God, the Dominican tradition insists, has already been acting in us.
Reflecting on our innate yearning for God, Bishop Barron affirmed, similarly to Father Murray, that while we may seek God, He has always been seeking us first.
God, with untamed love, knocks continually on the heart of each one of us. Stirred by this revelation, St. Catherine of Siena exclaims in one of her prayers, "O eternal, infinite God, O mad lover, are you really in need of your creature? It seems to me you are, for you act as if you could not live without her. Why then are you so mad?"
In addition to his 3 decades of teaching experience, Father Murray has also served as a spiritual director for many, including Mother Teresa, the founder of the Missionaries of Charity. Recounting a conversation he had with the saint in India, Father Murray shared insights into her inner thoughts about God's pursuit of our love.
I remember one day, many years ago, she turned to me in Calcutta and remarked that God is high, transcendent, all-powerful, almighty. I can understand that because I am so small. But that God has become small and that He thirsts for my love, begs for it, I cannot understand it. I cannot understand it.
If we're even half awake in life and in prayer, Father Murray explained, all of us will sooner or later hear God knocking on the door of our hearts. Not as a solemn dogmatist coming to judge us, but as a lover seeking the heart of his beloved. Opening the door to the living God requires, however, no small courage.
We are afraid of what we might lose, of what might be demanded of us. But if you think of it, all the men and women of faith whom we know and all the saints of our tradition tell us over and over that there's no reason to be afraid. The Lord who is knocking on our heart, the Lord who has come to visit us in the night, brings with him unimaginable blessing. But far from being a threat, what the knocking means in practice is nothing less than a call to freedom and joy, an invitation to a life of intimacy with God beyond all our wildest dreams. We have no reason to be afraid.
We'll be back after a short break with more on Vaticano. Blessing is older than the invention of the television. Nevertheless, most people today receive the blessing via media. Every year, Catholics all over the world gather around their televisions, radios, and internet live streams to be present when the Pope blesses Urbi et Orbi, the city of Rome and the world.
Urbi et Orbi. Das sind so komische Titel. Woher kommen die?
Urbi et Orbi might sound unusual, but let me explain what it means. This term refers to a special and most solemn blessing that a pope can offer. The blessing is traditionally given from the loggia, the blessing balcony of St. Peter's Basilica, immediately after the pope's election. Additionally, it is bestowed during Easter and Christmas, precisely at midday and always in Latin.
Gespendet.
The tradition of Urbi et Orbi blessings began in the 13th century and developed over the centuries. The blessing is reserved for the most solemn occasions, such as Easter and Christmas. It's also one of the first acts performed by a newly elected pope.
Aber es ist möglich, das werden wir auch im Heiligen Jahr sehen.
It's possible, as we'll see in the Jubilee 2025, for special occasions to prompt the Pope to impart the Urbi et Orbi blessing. A memorable instance was during the 2020 COVID pandemic. In March 2020, Pope Francis offered this blessing, standing alone in an empty St. Peter's Square, a powerful and unforgettable image. Exceptionally, the blessing included the Eucharist, Urbi et Orbi, which isn't usually done. In the presence of the Salus Populi Romani icon, a revered Marian image in Rome, and the Roman plague cross. This moment touched people worldwide, truly becoming a profound symbol of hope.
Und das war wirklich ein großes Zeichen der Hoffnung.
The Urbi et Orbi blessing is also associated with a plenary indulgence.
Throughout the centuries of church history, indulgences always have been linked to forgiveness. We understand that everyone who sincerely repents and asks God for forgiveness will receive it, a promise secured in the sacrament of penance through Jesus. However, sins often carry consequences, requiring amends. This concept introduces the idea of punishments for sins, leading to a distinction between the forgiveness of sin and the repayment for its consequences. This practice has evolved to the point where we talk about sin debt being settled over time. In contemporary penitential practice, we refer to plenary indulgences and partial indulgences. A plenary indulgence is comprehensive, addressing not just the sin, but also the guilt associated with it. A partial indulgence, on the other hand, covers only a portion of the sin and its guilt, though not specified in detail.
To receive a plenary indulgence during the Urbi et Orbi blessing, individuals must do the following: fully detach from all sin, confess their sins, partake in Holy Communion, and pray for the intentions of the Pope.
Et benedictio Dei omnipotentis, Patris, et Filii, et Spiritus Sancti, descendat super vos et maniat semper.
Amen.
The indulgence is available not just to those physically present in St. Peter's Square for the Urbi et Orbi blessing, but also to anyone who devoutly participates through radio, television, or the internet.
For us Catholics, it's important to remember, after celebrating Easter Sunday, let's turn on the television at 12 noon and tune into EWTN. Then we'll await the apostolic blessing, Urbi et Orbi, when the Pope extends God's blessing to the entire world.
Spendet.
The good news is, every Catholic has the opportunity to receive a plenary indulgence from 8 days before to 8 days after the Urbi et Orbi blessing. Therefore, Easter isn't just the most significant time of the year, it's also a prime moment for reconciliation with God.